KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Everybody in Silicon Valley texts all the time. There's not enough texting on the show, and I'm thinking...
And they work 18-hour code sprints. Right. They're not sitting around
talking.
Mike Judge, creator of Beavis and Butthead and the movie Office Space, turns his satirical lens on Silicon Valley in his new HBO series, Silicon Valley. He and collaborator Alec Berg talk about why there aren't any women of substance in the show and about losing a key actor to cancer. But first on the News Banter, the broadcast networks gear up for the upfronts. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, we often talk about the cost of live sports programming and how valuable it is because you don't tend to record it on your DVR. NBC Universal is going to pay a big bill, and they're thrilled to be paying it. $7.75 billion for exclusive broadcast rights to 6 Olympic Games, which means NBC Universal will be carrying Olympic events through 2032.
An amazing amount of money. And oddly enough, not a auction or a bid. I mean, it really kind of went in behind closed doors. NBC did it very well in the last Olympics. The IOC wanted to keep them. So they didn't even go out to Fox, ESPN, other companies that probably would have put up a bid as well.
And of course, that is going to be so far down the road by the time it's over that, you know, our colleague Mike Schneider questioned in his TV Guide magazine, will there be broadcast networks in 2032? Because as we know, that model is under challenge. But this is a wonderful time for me to segue to the upcoming upfronts in New York. I'm going to be headed there to be watching as the major broadcast networks unveil their new programming. And yes, this has been a time of challenge for the broadcast networks, but they are still the big tent and the big aggregator of eyeballs.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating is there's so much fluidity among the networks right now, and every network has its own story to prove, its own obstacles, its own issues. To me, what's really fascinating is that CBS, the top network, is probably the one that people are going to be looking at the closest because even though they're number one, really had a tough year last year.
Well, CBS is number one, and they are so very much number one that they could afford a weak year or two. You know, they didn't launch any big new shows, and they had some shows that didn't work, like Hostages and We Are Men. Those disappeared. They are definitely down in the key demographic, 18 to 49. But, you know, they're still CBS, and they still have the fewest problems, probably, in terms of holes to fill. I would say ABC, actually, right now, last place in the demo. They debuted 14 shows in 7 months between September and April, which shows you how much spaghetti ABC is throwing at the wall.
Yeah, not a lot of it's sticking either. If you listen to what we said about the upfronts a year ago, we'd probably be talking a lot about how bad NBC was. And I think NBC, oddly enough, has tremendous momentum. I would argue, and you might disagree, probably more momentum than CBS has right now because at least they're kind of moving in the right direction.
Well, certainly their numbers are trending in the right direction, and they're definitely doing way better. I mean, they are no longer the butt of every joke. I think ABC has won that privilege for now. NBC has had a couple of major, major moves with The Voice holding on and The Blacklist, a real, actual, you know, new show that works for them. And they also have Dick Wolf, who's just like this machine of programming with Chicago Fire and Chicago PD and
Chicago Animal Pound, I think, is it. Development right now.
And they're bringing back Law & Order SVU again. So NBC, and you know, the other thing that NBC did that worked so well that other people are now copying it, notably Fox with the production of Grease, they did that live Sound of Music with Carrie Underwood, which sounded like a setup for a bad joke and turned out to be hugely popular. So yes, NBC is not looking so bad.
No, and I think every other network, you mentioned Fox doing Grease, I think a lot of other networks, just like we talked about NBC and the Olympics, is going to look for that kind of sticky live programming. not reality shows, but live programming that you don't skip through on your DVR, that you watch live, that advertisers love.
Having said that, they will come up with a ton of new shows, which we will talk about next week when we've been through the upfronts. Michael Schneider and I will be talking about that. I will just go back to the idea of stuff that you don't DVR, you know, which is a problem for Fox. Fox had, for a long time, American Idol, huge, huge, you know, juggernaut Death Star, which just destroyed the competition. This is the first season that Fox has seen Idol come way back to earth. They will do it for another year. They will carry on, but it is nowhere near what it used to be, and that does create a problem for Fox. It just was an opportunity not only to pull in those huge ratings, but to launch other attempts at finding a hit. And, you know, without that, Fox does have a ton of work to do.
Yeah, but even with all those new shows, I think it's still going to be the case that you're only going to be watching a handful of them and a handful of networks. There was a fascinating story that was done recently by Nielsen, a study, that the average U.S. cable subscriber got a record 189 channels in their prepackaged bundles, but watched, again on average, only 17 of those channels. And that meant, obviously, you're paying for a lot of things you aren't watching. The average monthly cost of cable TV is about $90, and some analysts are now saying it will go up to $125 in the next year or two. A lot of that is to pay for things like the NBC Olympics deal. But it's fascinating that all of these bets on these very expensive programming are coming in a package that I think, and we have argued repeatedly, is an outmoded model. And I think it's going to go away. I think people are going to continue to cut their cords. So you talked about what the Olympics will be like in 2032. I suspect it might be beamed directly into your retina. the whole idea of the cable bundle is going to go away. People are going to have a la carte pricing, and they're going to pick what they want, just as they have in almost any other medium, including recorded music.
We shall see. And I just want to go out on a story that I just find, you know, fantastic in terms of how strange it is. You might remember the movie Bernie with Jack Black, about based on a true story about this guy in Texas who killed a 81-year-old lady, I guess, and put her into the freezer. He's been in prison for 17 years. But there have been some new revelations that he was severely abused as a child, and he's being released. But the part that makes the story so utterly strange is he's being released into the custody of the person who made the film about him.
Yeah, it's one thing for directors to fall in love with their characters. This is taking it a little bit far. Richard Linklater, who made the movie, has invited Bernie Tide to live in his garage apartment. So maybe they can get together and have movie nights, and, you know, Bernie can make his own suggestions of how the film might have turned out a little bit better. A very odd turnout. I hope it ends up well. It's not every filmmaker that invites a convicted murderer into his house. Let's hope this does not end badly.
Let's hope that there's no freezer in that garage. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Remember this?
I think Love Connection's on Channel 5.
Mike Judge was the creator of Beavis and Butthead, the co-creator of the Fox animated series King of the Hill, and now he's back with the new HBO show, Silicon Valley. This isn't the first time Judge has turned his insightful eye on the tech world. His 1999 movie, Office Space, was about unhappy wage slaves toiling in cubicles at a software company. Times have changed, and in today's world, those software nerds can become multimillionaires overnight. That phenomenon is at the center of Judge's new show, Silicon Valley.
You guys taking it all in? Because this is what it looks like when Google acquires your company for over $200 million. Look, Dustin Moskovitz, Elon Musk, Eric Schmidt, whatever the f*** the guy's name is who created Fotrio. I mean, Kid Rock is the poorest person here. Apart from you guys.
Once HBO committed to making Silicon Valley, Judge was joined by showrunner Alec Berg, whose credits include Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld. The pilot episode had been shot months earlier, but that's not what audiences saw when the series premiered in April, as Judge explains.
I wasn't completely happy with the original pilot, and when Alec came along, we rewrote, along with some of the other writers, some scenes, probably about a third of it, I guess.
Yeah, at least.
To do what?
It's more than, like, I looked at it again. I'm
it's actually
did
quite
more
a bit.
Than I thought.
Yeah, maybe even more than that. Yeah. So, and also, I mean, you know, you get to know the characters and you get, you know, as we're writing everything and kind of did more research, a lot of that had to do with, you know, like realizing that maybe we hadn't done enough originally.
You also, you approach a pilot differently than you approach a series, right? So when you're doing a pilot, you try and put everything into a pilot. And then once you know that you have 8 episodes, the pilot is really the first eighth of the first season.
The pilot originally is meant to be somewhat freestanding, like a thing with a big, you know.
Yeah, and it's also, I think you're doing, you know, TV is like this constant sort of R&D process where, you know, every episode you've done, you know more about the people in the show and you know more about kind of what works and
so
what does the great thing about TV.
Like, this guy would never do this?
A little bit. I mean, some of the characters, like I feel like Jared changed radically from the kind of who he was in the pilot to who he is in the series.
Can you identify Jared a little bit just so people who may not be familiar with the show?
Sure. Jared is played by Zach Woods. You may have seen him on The Office. And Jared is the business development guy.
He's also on Veep. He's getting
he's
a lot
Veep.
Of work
right,
these days. He was just on The Good Wife. That guy's everywhere.
He's on your television. Turn it on. And Zach is on there somewhere.
So you rewrote him to make him...
Oh, I wouldn't say... Well, I would just...
He's sort
I think,
just...
But
it's one of these things where in the pilot, he's one thing. And then as you kind of live with the character and you write the character and you kind of learn where he's funny and where he isn't. And the actor informs the process as well. It's like, oh, he's great playing this or that was a really funny thing he came up with.
And this one, I think once we, you know, once we got going we started getting into the writing process and the characters and everything and we started to go, wow, we could really make the pilot better by doing this and that, you know, and research and everything. So
yeah, it's becoming more and more common to do fairly radical reshoots on a pilot once you go to series. Right?
Also,
pilots are about deciding whether you're going to make a series or not, not making it the good first episode of the long run.
Yeah, and you know, HBO was also very supportive. They said, just, you know, if you wanted to reshoot as much as you want, what would it be? And
that's
we kind
nice.
Of started from there, so yeah.
You said that this was the first show I read that you said that this was the first show that was you'd done on TV that was not in front of focus groups first. Is that actually, you actually did a focus group on Beavis and Butthead? Because I'm trying to imagine what the,
well,
who you recruit for that
oh,
and
I
what
can
they
tell you.
Say.
That was a pretty, really interesting thing. I mean, it started with just 2 animated shorts that I'd made just in my house, not no focus group, anything, and they'd played in festivals, and so they'd kind of gotten some buzz, but MTV did take those. And then I put some music videos in them. We tried that out. And they took, so it was the first 2 shorts with some music videos in, and they played them. They sent me tapes of it. I wasn't there, but they were trying out a bunch of stuff from the show Liquid Television. So it was a bunch of animated stuff. And they show these kids, they're just fished out of a mall in Chicago, and they look like gang members to me, and they're just like sitting there. Half asleep. They just watched Aeon Flux, I guess. And like one of the guys just goes, oh, stupid. And then Beavis and Butthead comes on. And because I'd heard that this it's the greatest, you know, response we've ever seen from a focus group. And so I don't know what I'm expecting. But basically these guys are slouched in their chair and one of them just starts going, and one guy just starts losing it laughing. Then a couple others are laughing. And then when it's over, they ask one of them asks if he could get a tape of it, and another guy asks if he could get T-shirts.
They're like, woo-hoo,
so MTV
merchandise.
Was going ka-ching. But then there was another a group of women who were like late 20s that just hated it all the way around, and then a group of Jersey girls that loved it, except for one of them, and they got in a big argument. So anyway, I actually have a tape of those focus groups somewhere.
Almost sounds like you took the Beavis and Butthead with a laugh from the focus group as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a some kind of life imitating art thing going on.
Yeah.
But I mean, we didn't do they never did it on Curb either, right?
There's, no.
HBO kind of prides themselves on
– I mean, they have opinions. They're smart people, and they also hire people that they trust and let them do their jobs. I think it's why their shows are so good. I mean,
that's
to me, it's this
working.
Madness of, like, you know, networks do it all the time where it's like during the entire development process, people assert their opinions, and you have to listen to all these opinions.
Executives in this context?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, those people.
Yeah.
And then you finally have something that's done, and now they go, okay, we're going to take our opinions completely out of it, and we're going to put it into this machine, and the machine's going to tell us whether the show's any good or not. And for my money, it's like, look, you have 2 choices. Either give me your opinion, and let's trust your opinion, and let's go down that road, or shut the hell up, Let me do whatever I'm going to do. I can screw it up as well as you can. And then let's test it. Like if it's going to – if we're going to leave it up to a bunch of people turning knobs in a mall in Moline, Illinois,
right?
Let's just do that. And
pick
I'd rather
one.
Fail with my own garbage than yours.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Mike Judge and Alec Berg about their new series, HBO's Silicon Valley. After Judge made the successful animated show, King of the Hill, on Fox, he made a live-action pilot for the network that didn't make it onto the schedule. That process put him off of dealing with the broadcast networks to this day.
The experience was just so weird and awful with the network that shortly after that, I'd made Office Space, which had come out early in 99, and so this was, I think, in 2000, 2001 that we were doing this, and that movie was starting to get popular, and so it was before the British office and the American office, and they had said, what about doing a TV version of Office Space? And after that experience, I just said flat out, no, I'm not going to go through that again. You know, it was it's what Alex saying, it was just our opinions, like, okay, we don't like that music cue. We don't like that. We don't like that. And it's like, okay, well, what am I here for then? And they weren't helpful. There was an executive who would just stand behind me while we were shooting. I don't know if this person had ever been on a set before, but every time I would, you know, usually start with a wide shot and then you move in and she would come up and just say, are you going to get a close up? yeah, that comes next. Then the next setup, same thing. And just
got to earn that salary.
Yeah, it was a lot of that kind of feeling of people justifying their jobs. And
I saw that on the King of the Hill. They were also giving you these weird notes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'd wanted Hank to be 49 and that it took them forever to have a son. That's why he was so kind of overprotective and all his eggs in one basket, and because he had this narrow urethra thing. And so so I got a call, and it was one of the executives saying, yeah, you know, our audience is, you know, from 28 to – or from 25 to 35. So we'd like you to make him 34 if you could. And I was just going, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And then, but then I thought it's just a drawing and it's my voice. And so I just came back with the same exact drawing and voice and just said, okay, he's 34. And then we just later just, I think, settled on some age. Like, you know, I think we
– split the difference.
40-something, yeah. But.
So in this case, with this show, you work very hard to keep it authentic. I mean, do you get a lot of notes from Silicon Valley just generally, like random people tweeting
at
you?
You mean since it's aired?
Yeah.
We live in the Twitter age, so whether you want to hear from people or not,
yeah,
you're going to hear from them.
Shut them
like,
up.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if you're going to hear from them. They're definitely going to talk.
Yeah.
So you can hear as much or as little as you have, you know, the courage to.
Do you pay attention?
You know, I looked the first week or two. And I just wanted to see, you know, in general, like, you know, we're needy creative people and we're insecure and we want to know that everybody loves us.
I'd say like 90% at least.
Maybe at least. I'd say 95.
Maybe
like
more.
It's super,
are just,
super positive.
Just one after another, like spot on, spot on. And then someone who says you don't have it right.
And then you fix it on
like,
that one.
Well, then like the other people shouting that person down.
Yeah, that's been the affirming thing is that the people who seem to dump on the show are immediately dumped on by the hordes of people who are fans of the show. So they eat each other in a way. So we don't have to do – we just sit back and watch them maul each other.
Virtual bloodshed, yeah.
It's kind of cool to see the public responding to the things in the show the way that – just the same things that we like.
Right.
Yeah, it's
well,
kind of addictive too, especially when, you know, we've worked this – long and hard on this thing to go like, oh,
feedback.
Look at this.
The whole process, like from conception to writing to casting to shooting to editing, we're involved in all of it so much. It's this weird thing where you're like, you can be a micromanager of every facet of it. And then the most important part where it goes out to the world, you have absolutely no participation
no contact.
In. And it's just sort of, you just throw it into a hole and it's gone. You know, so Twitter is kind of one of these ways of,
right.
You know, actually hearing, you just see people tweeting back lines they like.
After a short break, the backlash against Silicon Valley's lack of women characters. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Mike Judge and Alec Berg, collaborators on the HBO series Silicon Valley. The show's 8-episode run will end in June, but it's already been picked up for a second season. Though the show's been well-received, some have criticized it for its lack of female characters. Judge says, blame reality.
It's definitely a thing up there. I mean, there's some footage that I took, not knowing that it would be in the show, but it's the audience at this TechCrunch Disrupt concert, and it's just a sea of dudes with a few women scattered here and there. And,
yeah, I think some of the most sexist stuff is the real stuff we cut
what
in.
What do you do about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like we're kind of making fun of the industry for not having women in it. And my ex-wife worked in tech. I know there are women in tech. It's just, you know, we started out, it's a story about this group of guys, and when we started, well, should one of them have a romance with somebody? You know, we had some ideas with that, but then it's, for the first 8 episodes, I mean, like the incubators we visited, like these guys, one of the first companies we met after it was greenlit and we were doing research, it's 5 guys living in a 2-bedroom apartment, and they're just busting their asses for 4 months doing code sprints and every, you know.
Yeah, so do you feel compelled to do something about this, or do you feel like, you know what, I'm an artist and this is what I'm painting, what I see?
No, I feel like gender imbalance is a huge issue in tech, and
yeah,
we owe it to the show and to the audience and to ourselves to satirize that in as best a way we can. But at the same time, I mean, our guys are software engineers in Silicon Valley. That's a job that's held, you know, 87% of the time it's held by men. So the reality is it's a massively male-dominated field. That's just what it is. But no, I think
we'd
love
to find
out. And
there are women in our, you know, when they get to the last 2 episodes, there's female tech people in them. When they get out of the house, finally, go up to this tech conference. But I mean, I lived up there and worked up there as an engineer, and that's what's kind of interesting about it. You don't see a lot of women. I don't know. You know, to find out why, that's something, it's something to look at and find a funny way to deal with.
Somebody on your cast, I'm not sure which one, called it entourage with Asperger's. I don't know if you feel that you are in fact portraying people with Asperger's.
Well, it's a broad definition of it. And
it's
more
become
just sort of a, I mean, I feel like I have a little bit of it myself, so I'm,
but you feel
it's
like
probably a funny catchphrase way to say it.
What are some of the other differences, like, you know, Hollywood versus Silicon Valley that you've noticed? We had Roy Price from Amazon on recently, the head of the, you know, making the original programming at Amazon, and he was saying that they don't go to lunch and they don't actually talk on the phone. That's not the Hollywood way. I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about they don't talk on the phone a lot.
Well, somebody wrote a very, I thought, left-footed kind of knuckleheady review of the show and just said, it's totally unrealistic because nobody on the show is texting. Everybody in Silicon Valley texts all the time. There's not enough texting on the show. And I'm thinking,
and they work 18-hour code sprints.
Right.
They're not sitting around.
They're not
talking.
Yes, that's compelling television.
Right, making jokes. It's totally wrong.
Our characters are doing that stuff. We're just not showing that part when the cameras are on.
No, our characters aren't defecating on camera either. It doesn't mean they don't do it. It just means we choose not to depict it.
The thing that you notice in Silicon Valley, these people who are really wealthy, they'll like build a crazy clipper ship or private islands fly a bunch of people on private jets to a party in Alaska, but they won't drive a Lamborghini or a Ferrari. There's this thing about you don't show off wealth except for in a certain weird kind of way.
Specified way.
And whereas Hollywood, you know, it's kind of, it looks a little more fun. It's more obnoxious also, you know, but like, I mean, Palo Alto, you'll look, people barely want to take care of their lawns. You know, on one hand, I kind of respect that. On the other hand, it makes the whole place look kind of drab.
When Silicon Valley returns for its next season, it will be missing the irresistibly eccentric billionaire investor, Peter Gregory.
Silicon Valley is the cradle of innovation because of dropouts. College has become a cruel, expensive joke on the poor and the middle class. that benefits only the perpetrators of it.
Christopher Evan Welch, who played Gregory, died last December after a long struggle with cancer. Did you know he was not well when you cast him in the show?
Not when I cast him.
Because he had been sick for many years.
And in the pilot, he was fine, and then he had a relapse of some kind right after. And then by the time we started shooting again, you know, gone through chemo, and my understanding, he was cancer-free, and he seemed fine. I mean, he seemed...
Yeah, that was my sense of it as well, is that he had dealt with this illness, but that he was through the woods, and...
That was his intention,
he came back
too,
and he said,
right?
You know, he said, I'm good to go. I want to, you know... His hair was shorter, so we had to, you know, do something with a wig and all that. But the death came as a shock for me. I mean, I knew it was somehow related probably to the chemo and all that, but it came out of the blue for me.
And was it a character that you were, I mean, I read somewhere that you weren't planning to keep him, but he was so fantastic.
I think we
would have
loved
kept him
to,
forever.
Yeah,
yeah. Incredible.
Okay, so that was wrong.
Really fun to write for. Well, I think what did happen is when, you know, he auditioned on tape for the part and was just, I was just thought this was, what he was doing was amazing. And really, like, he, you know, almost all of that, he just came to the table with that interpretation of it. I mean, maybe minor adjustments from us, but not much at all. And you know, it was just so fun to watch that, you know, we just started writing more stuff for him. So in that sense, yeah, no, we would have just kept on going with that.
So how do you deal with it when you lose an actor like that and you're not expecting it?
We had shot five
of the eight, and there was one kind of big storyline in six that we had to completely reconceive. And then there were patches of seven and eight that we had to just kind of rewrite. And
you hadn't shot them yet?
No. No.
We used his voice briefly in the sixth one.
So you have to explain in some plot way that we don't need to reveal here.
Yeah, although we had him out of the country, it's weird. Like, we had, like,
yeah,
I think the line about him being gone and at the beginning of seven was already there, right?
I think it was, yeah. He wasn't, we were explaining, I mean, we wanted it to seem like
he's this eccentric billionaire
that he had given up on Richard and the company, so he was sort of out of the picture a little bit. But so, he would have been in eight, the last episode.
I feel sometimes when you watch certain shows that are become really big, this character becomes the central character. And I always wonder, did the people who created the show know from the outset that this person was going to emerge as this, you know, not necessarily the star of the show, this kind of odd character? And I don't know if you anticipated him being, you know, he felt like he really emerged as this, you know, you wanted to wait, you couldn't wait for his next scene.
Yeah, I mean, I just seeing him, you know, shooting the pilot, I just wanted more personally, so I figured the audience would.
Yeah, but that's sort of what I was saying about, you know, every episode is the test lab for the next one, right?
So sit down and say, we're losing this major, wonderful personality, so what do we do to invent to fill that space?
Oh, for season two, yeah. Yeah, we'll have to. Yeah, we haven't done that yet.
I mean, we have some thoughts. I don't think we've solved it yet, but yeah, I mean, we're going to have to do something. I mean, it just is...
You can't replace him with... It's not like you could have anybody... To do a similar thing. I mean, I can't imagine anybody doing something like that.
You're doing eight at a time?
It's going to be 10 this season.
I mean, is that what you want? You want 10 or you like 10's too much?
I want 8.
I'd like to do 2 or 3. Apparently
but
it doesn't
HBO
work that way.
Is, they're like in 10. Feels like critical mass.
I think
mass
the other shows
them.
Also, Game of Thrones
with.
Is 10 and Veep is 10, so we're...
You fit with them.
The plan is to do all... Yeah, to do
10. Yeah, I think if they have to do 10, then we have to do 10.
Got it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Mike Judge and Alec Berg. Silicon Valley airs on Sunday nights on HBO and is available on HBO Go. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, be sure to check out our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.